Hello everyone and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. What's up? This is your host Matt and welcome to the show. How is everyone doing this week? I am in love with goldenrods. I've never really given them a chance before. I know identification with just field guides can be pretty difficult, and even when you have a key, it can be a challenge, but I've really begun to appreciate the diversity of this group. I can't even say a single genus because they've been split just across the landscape and all these cool, unique little habitat types. You know, just the other day we were walking around a fallow field and we found six different species of goldenrod that seem to be kind of distributing themselves among different kinds of soil types, because you get areas where the grass was a lot lower and you'd see like gray goldenrod, Solidago nemoralis, and in areas where it was a little more grown in, you'd get showy goldenrod, Solidago speciosa, and then mixed in you'd have, in the taller stuff, grass leaf goldenrod like Euthamia graminifolia and Solidago canadensis, the Canada goldenrod. It's just really nice to start to appreciate a group of plants that kind of all get lumped in and blamed for hay fever, even though they do not cause it. So that's inspired our latest video. If you head on over to youtube.com/indefenseofplants, you can see this video as well as all the others Grant and I have been producing. It's been a lot of fun, but this one is especially nice because it's all focused on goldenrods, and they're so showy and so beautiful and so easy to do justice to if you just take the time to pay attention to them. So yeah, youtube.com/indefenseofplants, go check out our latest video as well as all the other videos we've been producing. All right, what do I have for you today? Joining us is Dr. Chad Husby from the Fairchild Botanical Garden in Florida, and we recorded this conversation before Irma hit. It was at least a week before. And I've been kind of keeping track of, you know, I've got a lot of friends in Florida, so I watched that whole situation unfold, and, you know, my heart goes out to everyone that had to suffer the consequences of such a large and destructive storm. And, you know, this is going to be an ongoing issue for this country. And I think we owe our coastal communities a lot more, justice in terms of the way our system treats our waterways, treats our shorelines. You know, this is only going to get worse for these people. But, yeah, so Irma hit, but, you know, Chad came out okay. Fairchild is faring well. In fact, it says that the hurricane operations team was on site immediately following the storm. All of their buildings came through okay. A lot of the trees made it through okay, such as the palms and the cycads and the oaks. However, there was extensive damage to trees throughout the garden. There's plant debris everywhere. But there's a team actively working with equipment and other vehicles and arborists to work as fast as they can to clean this up and get it open again to the public and safe, you know, for everyone to go and enjoy. And, you know, just to offer a respite for people that are, you know, so in deep in cleaning up after such an event like that. So this conversation is pre-Irma with Dr. Husby, and this is kind of one that's been in the making. I've been trying to coordinate with Chad, but he's a busy man. He's been all over the world. He's always looking for new plants, and he brings a really cool element to plant conservation and, you know, plant education by being a botanical horticulturist. It's this beautiful melding of two realms of the hard science on plant conservation, but also the horticultural science on how to grow these species. And I think Chad stands as like a perfect example of what we desperately need in plant conservation moving forward. We can't have these little camps like, oh, I work on theory and I work on applied ecology. We need everyone talking, everyone working together, because the horticulturists being able to grow plants, it's one of the most important skills, whether that's to grow food or to save a species from the brink of extinction. So, you know, I'm really excited to bring this conversation to you because I think Chad is, you know, cream of the crop, and I can't speak highly enough about his work. However, before we get there, I've got a few orders of business to take care of first. First off, if you enjoy orchids and you care about orchid conservation efforts here in North America, head on over to indefenseofplants.com/shop and pick up one of our stickers. Every purchase you make, 50% of that goes to the North American Orchid Conservation Center, whose sole purpose is to increase the amount of research and conservation efforts being done on orchids here in North America. And as we've seen time and time again in the past, when you work to preserve orchids, you're benefiting much more than just an individual species. You're benefiting the whole community, from the soil microbes all the way up to the pollinators and even the canopy itself. So head on over to indefenseofplants.com/shop and pick up a sticker and know that every purchase is going towards a good cause. Also, if you're enjoying this podcast and you would like to support it, please head on over to patreon.com/indefenseofplants and see what we got going on over there. For a little bit of money each month, you can get yourself kickbacks like stickers, access to the VIP section of the indefensiveplants.com website. And for those of you looking to get just a little bit more, you can even get yourself a producer credit on this show. For instance, today's episode is produced in part by Alan, Holly, Clifton, Katharina, Shane, Amy, Caitlin, Rosanna, Mary Jane, Manuel, Jennifer, Sarah, Sienna and Garth, Troy, Margie, Laura, and Mark. So thank you to everyone who's given thus far. It really helps, and I mean that. Podcasting gets a little bit of expensive from month to month, and as I increase the Indefensive Plants presence, every little bit helps. If multiple donations are not your thing, you can give a one-time donation. Just head to indefensiveplants.com, scroll down on the right hand of the screen until you see the word donate, and you can give a one-time lump sum that will go directly into making this podcast better for you. If money isn't your thing at all, which I completely understand, poor grad student over here, at the very least, consider subscribing to and reviewing this podcast on whatever pod portal you use to download it. Reviews not only help me make a better podcast for you, but they also help Indefensive Plants reach a wider audience. All of the metrics that podcatchers use rely on people's reviews to make recommendations to people that haven't heard of the podcast yet. And since Indefensive Plants is here to cure plant blindness one person at a time, your review helps it reach more people. It's a simple equation. All right, entirely enough rambling for me. Let's head on over to my conversation with Chad Husby. I hope you enjoy. Well, Chad Husby, it's been a long time planning this, but I'm glad it's finally happened. Welcome to the podcast, and tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, thank you, Matt. It's a real honor to be here. I'm really amazed by what you've been doing and highlighting plants to the world. I'm a botanical horticulturist at Fairchild Tropical Botanic Gardens in Miami, Florida. And what I do is basically try to continue the legacy of Dr. David Fairchild, who was a early plant explorer for the United States Department of Agriculture and just loved plants. And the garden I work at is named after him, although it wasn't founded by him. It was founded by another fellow named Colonel Robert Montgomery, who was a plant enthusiast here in South Florida. And I try to introduce new plants to the garden for both the collections and which, you know, maybe for scientific purposes or for beauty or for because they would be a good new food, and also try to get those out to the public.
So it's not necessarily, you know, one mission for plants that you go looking for. It's kind of all-encompassing botanical interests then, huh?
Absolutely, yep. All kinds of different interests.
That's awesome. And it's cool that you said continuing this legacy, because that sort of legacy, a plant explorer for a government, just sounds so archaic. You know, it sounds like something that doesn't happen anymore, and it's really heartwarming to know it does continue, at least to some extent, maybe in a different capacity now. So how did you come across this way of expressing your love for plants? I mean, it doesn't sound like a job that most people know exists.
Yeah, that is very true. It's you know, this kind of work has become less and less common for all kinds of reasons, but I didn't plan to end up in this situation, though I'm very, very happy to be here. Actually, it just basically naturally evolved from just passions that I had over my life. I got interested in plants and, you know, in a major way in junior high, and followed them in, you know, whether as, you know, my main study or as kind of a side project through graduate school. And when I was doing my PhD, I actually had I came down here to South Florida. I'm originally from Michigan, so to Florida, yeah, absolutely. Coming down to Florida was, you know, we always would do, we'd come down for, you know, for winter breaks when I was growing up. So I always loved being in a place where plants were still green in December, you know, quite amazing.
Totally empathize with that.
Yes. And when I ended up being here for graduate school, I just went crazy, just, you know, collecting plants. There was some space in the university greenhouse at Florida National University here that wasn't being used for research. It was kind of more for the teaching collection. And I just started growing things I could never grow before. And and developed a database eventually to keep track of the information and where some of them came from as they got more and more special, what I was able to find down here. And then one of my professors talked to the director of another garden down here, the Montgomery Botanical Center, about that, mentioning that, you know, that I was just so interested in developing plant collections, even though it wasn't directly related to my research. So they must knew I must actually love it because it wasn't getting my research any further along. So in fact, the opposite probably. And then so when there was a job there, it came open at Montgomery Botanical Center for the collections manager, I was encouraged to apply and started out my botanical garden career that way. And then a couple of years ago, moved over to Fairchild after 8.5 years at Montgomery Botanical Center.
That's really cool.
To kind of keep expanding, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing, especially because, like you said, it was essentially a hobby that you really poured yourself into. And I think a lot of times, you know, people that do have really passionate hobbies don't know that there's an application for them. So for someone to recognize that in you and say, hey, you know, maybe your interests and your talents would be served in this sort of situation, that's really, you know, uplifting to hear that.
Oh, absolutely. It worked out in a beautiful way, and I'm really feel very, very fortunate it all came together. And one of the things that it drew me actually to being in Miami and South Florida was the kind of the universities and the botanical gardens being together, and it went just to be able to actually make that into a life and beyond graduate school was quite wonderful. Yeah,
I can imagine. And like you said, I mean, I think a lot of listeners can empathize with the fact that in the temperate zones, the sun goes away for like 6 months on a respectable end of the scale, and even longer for others. So to go to an area, you know, where green can happen year round, that as a plant person has to be a playground.
Oh, absolutely. You know, South Florida is the only place in the continental U.S. that's really verges on being truly tropical, especially in recent years.
Wow.
And so that's kind of made it a unique and special place for working with tropical plants. Why we have quite a few, you know, these interesting botanical collections down here, and you know, an interesting just history of people being fascinated by tropical plants who you know, many of them who grew up in the north left me and ended up coming down here and just, you know, went crazy with plants. And so it's been great to be part of that legacy. It's not just not only the botanical gardens and the universities and whatnot, but it's also all the wonderful plant people down here who just are passionate about plants, and being able to be part of that community is really great.
That's fantastic. Now, you work at Fairchild, obviously, and there's one of the main things that attracts me about Fairchild, at least in the in your online presence, which is wonderful that you guys are doing so much in outreach and showcasing what you got, is the fact that you're a botanical garden that's not all about getting ready for the next coleus show or the next poinsettia show. You're a botanical garden that's showcasing plants that might not be necessarily the most fanciful or, you know, well-known among generalized horticulturists. You guys are doing a lot of work on conservation as well, too. And just like I said, giving appreciation to plants that don't get, the limelight most of the time, even when plants are struggling to get to the limelight in general. So what is it about Fairchild that you like in terms of your approach to growing and caring for and showcasing unique species of the world?
Well, Fairchild, I like the fact that it's so multidimensional, just like you said, that's been a real opportunity to be able to kind of delve into all dimensions of the plant world pretty much, because, you know, there are the events, you know, we have, you know, our mango festival and other plant festivals are quite, you know, wonderful and, you know, way to highlight plants to the public and whatnot. But then, you know, we also have this legacy of scientific plant collections and, you know, just basically, you know, in the early days, the mission was to be a window on the tropics, basically be a place where, you know, the diversity of tropical plants was made accessible. Both to the public, to science, and to inspire young people, and that aspect has continued, and actually expanded because we're working a lot with local schools. We work with, you know, over 150 local schools, introducing students to the wonders of the world of plants and environmental science, and you know, we're also doing, you know, conservation work on native plants. We have a a team of people who work in the preserves here and work to save and propagate native plants. And we have, you know, lots of active researchers. We have graduate students from both Florida International University, the local public university, and the University of Miami, our major private university here, who are working at the garden and working with garden scientists. And we get lots of visitors coming all the time to do research here, to collect for their research or to study things in the garden. It's just a very, very dynamic and exciting place to work.
It's very uplifting to know that. You know, and again, I think a lot of it is just, I heard a really good talk this summer where the guy said, you know, the first generation built the botanical gardens, the second generation forgot about them, and the third generation is going to revitalize them in ways we never thought possible. And I think, you know, Fairchild and what you guys are doing, especially, you know, just seeing what plants you've been showcasing and stuff, you know, you guys really do have your finger on the pulse of what it means to be a botanical garden in this century.
Oh, absolutely. It's been, that's one of the things that's really, really attracted me to the garden, was just how it's, you know, taking the opportunities to really, really do things that need to be done, especially forming, you know, the next generation of botanists and culturists and just people who are aware of the environment and the wonders of nature, you know, especially in urban environments where often, you know, young people, especially these days, you know, don't, with all the kind of the absorption of the electronic world, can sometimes mean people don't get outside as much and whatnot. So now, you know, having this this garden here that's working so much with the schools, where it even becomes part of the curriculum, that has really really been encouraging to see.
Yeah, I think every town needs one of those.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about, you know, you as a plant grower. You know, what plants got you into growing plants? Was there anything that really stood out, or were you kind of like whatever you could get your hands on kind of kid? And how did that evolve for you, you know, throughout your graduate school career? And now obviously you've got access to a whole array of plants you never thought you would before. But what, as a hobbyist, were you growing?
Yeah, it's become harder and harder to think of what my favorite plants are, because there's so many. But it's... I really got the first plants that really captured my imagination were ferns, especially staghorn ferns, actually.
Oh, cool.
When I was in junior high, I actually started out being interested in animals more. But then over time, I kind of realized that it was a challenge to make animals happy in captivity. You know, I had a lot of aquariums and things, and I always wanted to have everything be happy enough that it would reproduce and you'd have multiple generations and all the wonders. This, the renewal of nature, really was fascinated me. And I, you know, but it was, that was hard to do with animals and hard to sustain, I realized. So, cause you know, they usually want space, and it's, and you know, usually they're limited with space in an aquarium and whatnot.
Yeah. And weight and sheer water weight on your floor support beams. I empathize with that one as a previous aquarist myself.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And then, you know, like issues of even genetic, you know, diversity, like having enough individuals so you're not going to be developing an inbred population if you do make them, you know, happy enough to reproduce. Is, you know, all those challenges were kind of started weigh on me as I read more and whatnot. And I dabbled with plants a little bit. You know, I've been sowing seed of spinach in our garden up in Michigan and thought that was very interesting, you know, that you could get that whole cycle going with, you know, plants, sowing them, they flowered, they would produce seed, and then you could replant the seeds. And that kind of started that idea in my head that, well, maybe plants are something you can kind of keep going much more readily and make them happy with you, you know, and kind of, so, because I like to be able to live with living things, with happy living things, as it were.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was reading, you know, some of these wonderful old houseplant books we had at home, like especially from the 1970s, when there was a big, you know, there was a big craze for indoor plants, and you know,
yeah,
you read all the instructions for how to set up fluorescent lights and whatnot, and I somehow I read in there about staghorn ferns and I saw some illustrations that they had this bizarre, you know, specialized shield frond, this leaf that, you know, would clasp onto things, and then these antler-like leaves that would grow out that were the fertile fronds. And that just, and so I asked my mom about them, and we went on, you know, a whole tour of our little city up in northern Michigan, going from florist shop to florist shop, seeing if we could find this creature, this staghorn fern. And actually, we did find one at one florist shop. And I just remember, I was just, you know, so happy.
Beside yourself to finally see it.
Yeah, because it was just like this wonder of, you know, from the other side of the world. And right. Here it was, you know, and I could bring it home and grow it. And
were you successful in that first attempt? Because I know my first foray into the world of keeping plants was bad.
Yeah, actually, I was successful with that first staghorn, which was fortunately a fairly one of the easier ones to grow. And I had already kind of been, you know, I'd been studying so much those old, you know, indoor plant books that I kind of followed the directions. And we had a nice big picture window, which let in lots of light and eastern light.
There you go.
And that turned out to be, you know, a good situation. And I had also seen that I could supplement light with fluorescence because that's a flower shop. So when I did that, surprisingly enough, it actually started growing and I was very happy.
That's fantastic. So it's cool because, you know, a lot of times you hear stories like, oh, orchids or carnivorous plants, which, you know, those were kind of my gateway drug, so to speak. But it's nice to know that ferns are getting their attention too, especially in the horticultural trade. And that's kind of carried on into your professional life too. I mean, you kind of, following you on social media, I see you've got an appreciation for ferns and, to use an archaic term, their allies, right?
Oh, absolutely. That passion has continued. And I, you know, ended up even doing my PhD work on giant horsetails, which are one of that group. And yeah, I mean, I think it partly because I love symmetry in things. And, one of my parallel pursuits was mathematics along the way and statistics. So
that makes a lot of sense.
You know, absolutely. And I just like ancient things in general. So, it really captured my imagination when I was growing up and then went on to college because I noticed in the springtime, you know, this area where there had been some fill soil put in where we lived. And each spring, this little forest, it would look like miniature conifers would spring up that were a little field horsetail like the Sedum arvensi. And then when I went away to college and I took a botany class, I read in my botany text that these were survivors, you know, from hundreds of millions of years ago, from plants that used to be a major part of, at least part of the coal swamps and of that time. And that just, I was hooked.
That feeling where it just lights that fire in your belly and you're like, yep, this is going to be a long time coming.
Oh, absolutely. And then, oh, it was amazing. And then I was really fortunate to be in the same state as the main leader of the fern world at that time, Dr. Warren Herb Wagner, who was a professor at the University of Michigan. And so I wrote to him, and despite his preeminence in botany at the time, he very kindly wrote back and told me different places I could see different types of equisetum, different horsetails around Michigan, and really encouraged me to continue my studies. So it was really...
That's fantastic. You know, it's nice to know that, like you said, even someone of prominence can still kind of reach out to those of us that are yearning for knowledge and inspire, you know? I mean, that's what's cool, I think, about a lot of the best professors I've had is that they recognize that maybe you're not into what is traditionally being taught, but if they do find something that, or you find something that you've latched onto, it's like, well, go explore that more. If you're into it, then do it.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was kind of a great exemplar of that. And, you know, what a difference that can make in someone's life, you know, that encouragement, you know, from on high sometimes can be a big thing, you know, and when I went to visit him, he spent 3 hours with me, took me to the herbarium and showed me giant horsetail specimens that would, you know, where you'd lay out multiple herbarium sheets until you get to the full length. That was one of his favorite things to do in class. I never got a chance to take a train, but it took me out to see a rare hybrid, which was so fascinating. Wow. And just said, you know, there's nobody working on this group now, so we need somebody, so do it, please. So he was And his an interesting little side note was that one of his favorites people to botanize with was actually not a professional botanist, but a UPS driver who just loved the Butyrchium ferns that he loved. So.
That's fantastic. I mean, those are some of my favorite botanists are the ones you meet at botanical society meetings that are just like, oh yeah, you know, I'm an accountant, but on the weekends, and it's sometimes 10 times more knowledgeable than most academics in terms of the genera they enjoy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That's one of the things I really love about botany and horticulture is how kind of egalitarian it is that people, you know, people of all different, you know, backgrounds, all different walks of life and all around the world, you know, fall in love with plants and pursue them, which is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I've spent hours combing the scientific literature about the species that I'm personally working with for my academic work. But, you know, it's meeting these old-timers, you know, not to disparage or anything, but just older folks that have gardened for their entire lives or just been hobby botanists on the weekends for their entire lives. And I've actually extracted more useful knowledge of my study species from them than I really have anything in the literature. And it's a real shame, and I've said it before, is that a lot of times ecology and horticulture don't hang out together, when in reality, I really don't know how they can function long-term without each other.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, that. And, you know, and it's true that knowledge, you know, that you find from horticulture and from people who just spent their lives, you know, with growing these wonderful plants, you know, often the only way that gets passed on is through those personal interactions, because there isn't really, you know, there isn't really a place that gets preserved in the literature very much. I mean, there used to be, and more so, you know, like you read, like I've found it interesting, like reading the American Fern Journals from, you know, back in the early 20th century. And there was you know, more of a place than in various journals for somebody to write, hey, here's something interesting I observed about this plant that I was growing, or something I saw, you know, that may have not been a, you know, anything that linked with any grand hypothesis or anything, but a place to just kind of share things that they observed, you know, about, like John Schaffner, who was at Ohio State University back then. You know, he was the horsetail person at that time. He would just publish an article, here are these interesting, you know, developmental abnormalities I saw in horsetail stems around here, you know.
So these, like, this idea of like the natural history notes, so to speak.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that was kind of where that aspect of things kind of could get into the literature a bit. But then, you know, I don't know that we've ever had a lot of the horticultural knowledge passed on in any way other than, you know, like you said, just kind of from meeting these wonderful people and imbibing their wisdom, and which is it's a very different kind of wisdom, because it's, you know, actually kind of spending your time going through the entire life cycle of a plant and learning to propagate it and whatnot. You know, you get a whole different set of knowledge than you do, say, if you're going to do, you know, an intensive several year study on it and it's resulting in a scientific publication. You know, that's different than spending your life with it. So it's
certainly, yeah. And again, and not to discredit either side of that, it's just more conversations, or at least hanging out in the same room would be nice. But, you know, and this idea of Equisetum I really like, is because it's a group that, you know, I think a lot of people actually do readily recognize, but it's just kind of like, they're largely thought of as these plants of waste places, or some of them that can be kind of aggressive. They get in your garden and kind of take over. But, you know, you found a passion for them. And in fact, my introduction to you as a person, or just knowing of your existence in the horticultural realm, was downloading pictures of Equisetum giganteum, which is, you know, hopefully a species you can speak to a little bit. But there's a lot of diversity in that group. And you've highlighted these as one of the groups of plants you really like to work with.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, horsetails, one of the things that I really got fascinated with about plants was the fact that many of them, you know, can propagate vegetatively and clonally, because that, just the, you know, the idea of perpetuation of nature was something that really interested me. And the fact that plants, you know, they could clone, they could actually, you know, kind of escape the bonds of kind of the individual life that, like, we have, where most mammals, you know, we're born, get old, and then die. And whereas, you know, plants can grow vegetatively sometimes, and and just keep growing indefinitely as long as the environment allows and plants don't, you know, don't get old in the ways that we do. And that all fascinated me. And Equisetum was like the example par excellence of this, because here's a plant that has this extensive underground rhizome system and can just spread indefinitely. And also many of its, you know, many hybrids in Equisetum persist even in the absence when their parent species have disappeared from an area purely by vegetative reproduction. And so that aspect of horsetails also just really attracted me to them. And when I read in one of my undergraduate texts, there was just one line there saying, oh, there are these giant species in South America that can get 5 meters high. And then, yeah, I was hooked from then on. I got to get to see these somehow, because there weren't many. Even back in the 90s, it was really hard to find even a photo of the giant one. So,
yeah, and then when you do finally see them, like, I was shocked to learn that we still had giant species on this planet. I thought they had all went the way of the coal swamps. But then to finally see a picture of them where you have some context of size, I realize seeing them in person probably is beyond that. But it's really feels like you're looking back in time to an era that, you know, if you're a kid that liked dinosaurs, you thought was gone.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the primeval aspect of these plants is really, especially the giant ones, is really just overwhelming sometimes. In fact, when I the first one I saw in the wild was actually in Panama. I was taking an ethnobotany course, and then we had in the middle of the course, this was all in the lowlands in the Bocas del Toro archipelago there, and we took a break in the highlands, in the mountains, about halfway through the course, about 2 weeks in, and I had looked up, you know, whether there were any herbarium collections of the giant horsetails there, and it turned out that, yeah, there had been. And so while everybody else was off in the hot springs, I was hiking down from the cloud forest, just hoping to get a glimpse of these somewhere. And when I just about got back to the town and was about to give up, there I just saw out of the corner of my eye the chute coming up from the drain under the road, and it was a horsetail, and it was the giant horsetail. Equisetum giganteum, and just, you know, going back there and seeing these stems that were, you know, 10 feet or more high and their perfect symmetry and everything, it just felt like I was going back to the, it just looked so alien, like these plants shouldn't be here in the modern flora.
Yeah, kind of those moments where like the hair stands up in the back of your head, you're getting goosebumps, you're like, what just happened?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you just kind of, it's like, can I spend like the next 2 weeks right here?
I got a tent. I don't mind. I'll eat potatoes if I have to.
I could just never wanted to leave that little patch.
That's so cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you grown these species or been able to work with them in a horticultural context at all? Or are they something that's probably best kept outside?
Oh yeah, I had to try, and you know, because the dream would be to, of course, have these growing and accessible, you know, more widely. And it turns out they're not, actually most of them are not that hard to grow. The giants are not that hard to grow. The ones I studied specifically for my PhD, mostly in the Atacama Desert in northern Chile, were actually hard to grow. So there are a couple around, because I sent specimens around, but they were hard to grow in our humid climate here. But the giant horsetails from other locations have proven quite amenable to horticulture, and I still have actually many clones here with wild origin data on them, and they're there.
That's
exciting. And I've shared them with lots of botanical gardens and universities. Yeah,
cool. And that's the other cool part, is you get to kind of trade plants among professional growers and, okay, we've got these from this region of the world. What do you got for us? Kind of thing. It's kind of facilitative in its own beautiful little way.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the joys of the plant world, is that plants are so shareable. You know, humans have been taking advantage of that for a very long time. And, you know, that they're kind of the perfect renewable resource, because you can give a propagation of a plant to somebody else and it doesn't diminish the original plant for you. And, right. You know, that's a beauty. That's something that always I found inspiring about plants. In addition to the fact that they're not, you know, aging physiologically, that, you know, so nobody's saying, oh, was that plant, how long ago was that plant a seedling? Because it's running out of steam now. No.
bunch of geriatric plants sitting around going, when I was young. That's
yeah,
funny.
Exactly. So just those two aspects just make, you know, so much, for me, it just brings so much joy to the plant world that you can kind of share the joy with everybody and whatnot and the wonder of these things.
Now, another group that you have been just blowing up on Twitter, I can't not stare at them every time you post a picture, are these the wonderful variety of Selaginella, the spike mosses as they're called, which, you know, they're not ferns, they're not equisetum, but they're kind of lumped in with the lycopods in there, but that's a big variety of different plants that goes far beyond the little fairy plant garden ground covers that you see at just generic nursery centers, and you've introduced the world, or at least you are introducing the world, to a wide variety of some pretty spectacular species.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Selaginella, as you mentioned, it's an amazingly diverse group and very little known, you know, outside of a few species that do get around. I first got interested in them because, you know, there's a couple species that are iridescent blue. That do circulate in horticulture a bit, and once again, they're another of these surviving groups. You know, the lycophytes are the most ancient. You know, I guess most ancient lineage would be a safe way to express it of of vascular plants, and you know, they're kind of sister to all the other vascular plants, and in a sense, you know, even though they've kind of been called fern allies, that they're actually not particularly close to ferns, and their symmetry, their architecture, their look is so fascinating, ancient. And it turns out, Selaginella turns out to be the easiest group of lycophytes to cultivate, and they are tremendously diverse. And it's just, you know, there are at least 700 species. I'm sure there are plenty more that we haven't described. You know, they do some fascinating things because, like other lycophytes, their roots branch dichotomously. You know, only of the vascular plants, only lycophytes do that. But in Selaginella, you can often even see it happening. You know, because they often will produce these rhizophores above ground, and then they'll start to branch. And that really got me interested in them as well. And the fact that they're mostly fairly easy to cultivate, and some are quite difficult. But then that some exhibit some really surprising behavior, like have these iridescent blue colors, as I mentioned. And then I discovered through actually one of the great people of the fern world, Dr. Barbara Jo Hoshizaki, passed away a few years ago, but she was the leader of the fern horticultural community for a good chunk of the 20th century, later 20th century. And once I had the privilege of visiting her, and she shared with me this one Selaginella from the Caribbean called Selaginella serpens, and highlighted that plant actually can change color. So during the day, it's green, and then in the evening, it turns silver colored. And I mentioned this to one of the professors on my graduate committee, Dr. David Lee, who actually one of his specialties is plant color, and he was writing a book on plant color, which has since come out at Timber Press. That's Nature's Palette, it's called. And he had never heard of this before, so I gave him a plant of it to study, and he kept it at home and waited till the evening and looked at it under its cells under the microscope during the day and in the evening. And he figured out that actually each of those cells had a single chloroplast. And during the day, the chloroplast was flattened out along the bottom of the cell to catch light. And so it looks green like normal plants do. And then at night, it would into a much smaller sphere. So most of the light would just be going through the cytoplasm. And that helped to give it that silvery color.
Wow. That's bizarre.
It's totally amazing. Yeah, I would have never guessed such a thing could be. And now I've since learned that other Selaginella do that too, a few others, even a couple from the other side of the world. So that's a really intriguing phenomenon.
Yeah. I mean, do you have any hypotheses as to why that would function that way? Is it something about the what goes on at night with respiration or some sort of carbohydrate transport system. Is there any ideas as to why they would have such rapid changes in their chloroplast orientation?
You know, I really don't, which is which is strange, because the thing is it ends up being kind of the opposite of what you might hypothesize for such a change. You'd think that maybe that would be something they do during the time of maximum irradiation to protect their their photosynthesis system, but it's happening in the evening. And actually, Dr. Lee didn't have a hypothesis, and he wrote to his friend, the great plant physiologist, Dr. John Raven in the UK, and he also had no real hypothesis. So it's if any students or something are listening to this and have bright ideas, this would be a great project to pursue.
I love that, because not only is it a new question that, you know, we don't know, the great minds don't know, but it's also this, it's doing something that you don't expect plants to do most of the time, is changing rapidly in the period of a few hours. And that is just too cool to want to pass up. So yeah, listeners, get on that.
Absolutely. And I was recently, earlier this year, in the Cameron Highlands in Malaysia, and walking through the wet forest there, and came across some other Selaginellas that were apparently the same species. Some individuals were just white, and then Whoa. Some were green, and it looked like they were changing color there too, although not all of them. So that's another dimension that's very perplexing.
Another gear to complicate the movements and confuse people for decades to come.
Absolutely, and that's one of the wonderful things about plants, is sometimes they haven't read the book on how they're supposed to behave. So.
I love that. Yeah, it's anyone's guess, and that's, again, the idea that these low-hanging fruit are all picked clean, you know, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, is just preposterous. There's so many things, especially for groups that don't get mainstream attention, that are worth investigating and just begging for discovery and explanation.
Oh, absolutely. The opportunities are pretty amazing, you know. And then a lot of groups of plants, they haven't had, you know, all that much attention, considering. I mean, certainly Selaginella is a good one, because it's, you know, they're still just working out a lot of the taxonomy is still, you know, something that needs to be done, much less all the amazing things that can be done with physiology. And, you know, there's been some work on some of the iridescent species, on the thin film interference that creates that iridescence, which is quite remarkable, but there's so much more.
Yeah.
And even in the pteridophytes, which are just like less than, I mean, 4% of the vascular plants, and that's a whole universe that there's so much to do.
Right. No, and that's the beautiful thing about it, is once you kind of sneak your way into this world, all of these doors open up, and a lot of them have never been opened before.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's still... can still explore and discover so much, you know, that, yeah, I think then that's something it'd be nice for people who are just getting into this field to know, you know, is that you can still be an explorer, and you can still discover wonderful things. It's not too late. You know, I mean, they're even, you know, I'm just hearing that, you know, I mean, that they've just discovered, you know, the world's tallest tropical trees, you know, in Sabah, that they're these dipterocarps that, you know, are taller than any other, and, you know, hiding in plain sight, as it were. And,
right.
And apparently, even some coast redwoods that may surpass the giant sequoias in mass that you know have only recently been documented, and you know, so even enormous things are still there to be discovered.
Yeah, that's a good point too. It's not just these obscure little things tucked away in some tropical montane forest. It's there's giants out there that we've just, you know, it's hard to believe that we haven't touched and looked at every single surface of this planet. And then even harder to understand that, like, just because maybe someone saw this doesn't mean it was the right person to see this and recognize it as unique. That's the other part too.
Oh yes. Yeah. That's the you know, remarkable dimension to it. It's the, you know, I mean, really so much of, you know, of science, you know, that like, requires that amazing instrument that's, you know, been with us for all along, which is, you know, the human mind and just the enthusiasm and passion for discovering things and for asking questions. You know, that's such a crucial thing, that, you know, even we may have all the best technology in the world, but if somebody doesn't have that passion, you know, the not going to get done.
Yeah. Very true, very true. Now, another group that you work with that I see frequently on your Twitter account, and it's one that I was recently introduced with and introduced to at the Atlanta Botanical Gardens, are these weird tropical conifers, specifically like Podocarpaceae and Araucariaceae. And you've worked with a few, like at the Agathis species. They're bizarre, and I don't think enough people realize that tropical conifers exist, because you think conifers, you think, you know, the Rocky Mountain West, arid areas, mountainous areas, with tiny little pine needles, but there's tropical conifers that grow with their roots completely submerged, and they've got these strange, you know, leaf-like needles. It's a weird group, and you are very lucky to be working with some of them, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's another group that really captured my imagination. I started looking, for a long time, I'd been interested in the Araucarias, the tropical group of tropical conifers that are quite ancient and, you know, are often used in backdrops for, you know, dinosaur recreations and whatnot, because they have that look, the radial symmetry and the small leaves, small needles and whatnot. Once resources became available online for like looking at more of the flora of for example, New Caledonia, which is this kind of a Noah's Ark for these ancient tropical conifers with like 46 endemic species on one island the size of New Jersey of tropical conifers. And I started looking at this site, endemia.nc, which has photos of much of the flora. This was like 10 years ago. And I just, when I started seeing how some of these tropical conifers that grow there looked, it was just, you know, another one of those moments, like with the giant horsetail, like, you know, I've got to know more. I've got to see more. You know, this is just incredible that these things share the planet with us. And, you know, and how did I not hear about them before? You know, and then I was told by a local plant friend at the Marie Selby Botanic Garden, Harry Luther, who was an amazing self-taught botanist who knew about just about every plant group. And he said, you know, you need to go up, you know, get in touch with Ron Dieterman at the Atlanta Botanical Garden and go up there and look at these and see these things. So, so yeah, I made a pilgrimage up there. And
so you were lucky enough to get the Ron tour. The Ron tour was one of the most fundamentally amazing things I've ever experienced in my entire botanical adventures. Ron is an incredible human being, and I think the world would be worse off without him.
Oh, you said it beautifully. Yeah. Yeah. That's been a relationship that's been fantastic for, you know, for the last, I guess now 11 years or so. Cause I've actually, since my first visit back in 2006 to Atlanta, I've gone up there once or twice a year, bringing plants there and bringing plants back every year. And it's been, and then I went with Ron. We actually, got funding from the USDA, which still has actually funds some plant exploration work, and to actually go to the Royal Botanic Gardens Edinburgh together to propagate tropical conifers there from the International Conifer Conservation Program.
Because they lack.
Oh yeah, absolutely! It was amazing, and so we really have. And then we went to New Caledonia together to participate in a conference on plants that could be used for ornaments and things in the French territories that moves from one to another. And so when they did it in New Caledonia, we were able to present on New Caledonian plants that were in cultivation out, you know, in North America. And so we've been, you know, working on that, on these tropical conifers, and especially New Caledonian ones ever since. And it's been amazing.
And that's a really good example of how learning how to cultivate and grow these plants in captivity, you know, thousands of miles away from where they're native, can feed back into conservation efforts. Because, you know, New Caledonia, places like that, like Fiji, they're in trouble with tourism, they're in trouble with mining. You know, these are areas where these really endemic species, these really sensitive species, could go missing from the world forever. And just being able to show and teach people how to cultivate them could save a lot of these species from the brink of extinction, you know, when some rare earth mineral is found growing, you know, in the rocks underneath the one stand where this plant grows.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's in those situations, It's, in fact, I think it's getting more and more important, as you said, because, you know, as the threats to different plants increase, and what, you know, all over the world, and especially on these very, you know, kind of circumscribed habitats, like where, you know, New Caledonia has at least 20% of the world's nickel, and much of that is concentrated in the areas where these, you know, that those are the areas, these, the serpentine soils where these special conifers congregate, because basically because they're so good at adapting to the stressful conditions that it reduces the competition from the angiosperm flora, the flowering plants. But then, you know, that in many cases, if a small population of these conifers is under threat, if you know how to propagate them and whatnot, you can often make a backup of an entire population. You know, if there are, you know, anything less than 100 or so, it's, you know, and you can take cuttings or you can graft them, and, you know, it's a very powerful conservation tool in some of these cases. And so, you know, and the experience of botanic gardens, like in Atlanta, they even were able to, you know, feed back to Fiji with one of the tropical conifers they were doing, working with Eric Papaiwaniana. And because, you know, Atlanta had the most experience in the world of propagating that plant vegetatively. And
it's incredible.
Which was pretty fascinating, yeah.
I think one of the coolest aspects of what they have going on over there, at least on display, that the public can go and readily see all the time, is the fact that a lot of these tropical conifers, you know, you mentioned you can take cuttings of them and root them and have them grow into clones of the parent plant, but there's a difference whether or not you take a cutting from a vertical tip or a horizontal branch. And what I love is the fact that they took all these cuttings of horizontal branches and they never righted themselves. They just continued growing as horizontal branches. So they have all these weird kind of espalier, like half espalier, where a branch comes out of this hanging basket and just kind of runs its way along the wall and grows for feet after foot after foot. It's really kind of endearing in a weird way to display these species, but it's one of those, well, we took clippings of the wrong part of the tree, but it's still the tree and it's growing. We're just going to display it how it wants to grow.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a fascinating phenomenon. And, you know, it's been observed for quite some time, like where they'd have, I remember reading about a branch of an Araucaria heterophylla, the Norfolk Island pine, that, you know, one garden it had for 50 years and it was still growing as a branch, you know, and making branches, but they were also flat branches. So none of that, you know, and... So yeah, it's a fascinating phenomenon, and it's also, it's kind of a good example, I think, of how, you know, sometimes there must be certain molecular switches, you know, probably call it epigenetics or something, that, you know, where these branches, they just remember indefinitely that they're branches, whereas in other conifers, they will snap out of it eventually, like the genus Cunninghamia. You know, if you take a cutting of a branch, it will grow, you know, kind of snake around the ground for a while, but then it'll throw up a vertical shoot. You know, it might take a year, 2 years, and so it's interesting how some, you know, it's like it's more of a permanent change, and some it's something that can eventually get reprogrammed somehow, and then it can vary even within the same genus of conifers. Some of them will very readily kind of reorient themselves from a horizontal cutting, and some will just keep growing as this kind of interesting, snaky thing.
Just the charming qualities of individual species, and that's why you should never forget, never try to broad brushstroke your way out of individual species, because, you know, I don't believe in neutral theory. I think every one of them is its own unique little ecological unit, and it's going to behave the way it evolved to behave, regardless of what we think about it. Like you said, they don't read our books.
Yeah, well, that's very true. And speaking of that, there was a very odd phenomenon occurred. I developed in collaboration with Atlanta, Edinburgh, and lots of other partners, and University of California, Santa Cruz has a great tropical conifer collection too, to build a conifer collection at Montgomery Botanical Center, where I used to work, with, you know, over 130 species
nice.
There. And one of the interesting phenomena that occurred, you know, I'd heard from Ron and from Harry Luther at Selby Botanic Garden that the what were called Norfolk pines down here were not really Norfolk pines. And I'd seen that in where I was in Chile too, and noticed that what they, the Araucarias they were growing there that looked like, that they called Norfolk pines, didn't look like ours in Florida. And it turns out they're actually cook pines from New Caledonia, Araucaria columnaris. So, and even all the things you will find in, you know, for Christmas trees, for indoor Christmas trees and in Home Depot or wherever, you know, in various stores for growing up north, those are also cook pines. They're not, they call them
Norfolk. I bet mine is a cook pine. I never thought of it that way, but we just got it from some sad little grocery store stand. We're like, oh, this poor thing, we got to see it. It's covered in glitter. Oh, cool, I probably have a cook pine. That's great.
Yeah, you almost certainly do, because most of the seeds for those come from Hawaii, from plantings in Hawaii that have been there since the 1860s. And they, at some point, they started to call them, you know, Norfolk Island pines, and but they are actually these cook pines. And so I was really keen to find the real thing and get them growing, of the Norfolk Island pines, and get them growing in the gardens down here. And I had to write to Australia, where they actually have both taxa growing. And they sent me seeds of the true Norfolk Island pine. It turns out the cotyledons of the Norfolk Island pines are much larger as little seedlings. They're actually very easy to tile apart, but then when they get a little older, it's not so easy. So unless you have them side by side to compare.
Now there's an interesting phenomena where the seedlings are easier to identify than the adults.
Oh, yes, yes.
That in and of itself.
Yeah, when they get to be fairly good size, then the differences prop up again. But it's kind of the intermediate stage is when, you know, is when it's hardest, and that's when, you know, we usually obtain them. So
the awkward teen years. Like.
Yeah, exactly. and it's just as an interesting little side note is that cotyledon difference, it seems like even there's a lot of morphological diversity of the Araucarias in New Caledonia. You know, there are 13, actually now 14 species. I just described a new one. You know, and that's 14 of the world's 19 or 20 species, and there's quite a bit of variation in their mature form there. Some with really wide, large leaves, some with smaller leaves, and differences in kind of their architecture. But it turned in that cotyledon difference. You know, even though the New Caledonian species, sorry, the Norfolk Island species, looks very similar in many ways, especially at that in those awkward teen years, as you were mentioning, that even though it looks a lot closer to, say, the cook pine than it does to, say, you know, some of the other with species there with really large, wide leaves, but that cotyledon difference, you know, all the New Caledonian seedlings I've seen, they all have those really narrow cotyledons, whereas the Norfolk Island one has the wide cotyledons. And, you know, it turns out all those New Caledonian species are apparently in a single clade. And wow. So that may be kind of where their common heritage shows up there most clearly in a morphological way.
Oh, that's so cool. I mean, just ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny and all those sayings you could have. But again, it all comes from an intimate knowledge of these species at various life stages. And that is why I love horticulture so much.
Oh, absolutely. And then you can observe some things that really you couldn't find out any other way. So when I got these seeds of the true Norfolk Island pine and grew them and saw these interesting cotyledon differences, and then I planted some of these in the garden at Montgomery, and one of them, which is quite a large specimen now, it actually started exhibiting a really bizarre phenomenon, because these horizontal branches, which are kind of the canonical branch that will just remain a branch even if you root it, mm-hmm. They started to revert to upright growth at the tips, to looking like a miniature, you know, a miniature art copy of the original tree. And I asked people who studied, you know, Araucarias and conifers, had you ever seen anything like this? And no, nobody ever
seen. Nope, new thing. Congratulations.
Absolutely. So I've rooted cuttings of those that are now growing, of those branch tips that reverted. And so, you know, years down the road, we'll see if they start doing that again. Because, you know, just in something that where the programming, you know, to continue that horizontal flattened growth is so strong, to have them just kind of reverting even on the tree is really strange. But I mean, I can imagine having a specimen that does that would be wonderful for researching, you know, if you were looking at the molecular control mechanisms and whatnot.
Oh, totally.
If you have something doing that, you could actually, you know, track gene expression on branches that stay stay horizontal and those that revert, and you know, and that's another thing that by growing these plants, we can often discover things that can then be useful for research that we didn't even imagine would be something that could be done, you know. So.
And that's the other part too, is just the stuff you don't realize could come out of it. Any sort of stifling, I just don't understand it, because you don't know. You just don't know, and until you do it, you're never gonna know.
Oh, that's so true. Yeah, and the thing is that plants, like, you know, we mentioned that they can behave in ways that you just wouldn't predict, and you know, you've just got to kind of have that open mind for discovery when you're working with them, and realize that they may grow in unusual ways. They may grow under conditions they're not supposed to grow under, you know, because like I grow a couple of horsetails down here that are from very cold climates, yet they adapt to a hot, humid, like I've got one from Prince of Wales Island in Alaska that is, strangely enough, perfectly happy down here.
Bizarre in your subtropical climate. I mean, I've always marveled at the fact that I've got high elevation Nepenthes growing in central Illinois. I mean, they don't like the heat of the summer, but there's times when you make it work, and that's half the fun, is just figuring out how to kind of finagle the position or what you're doing with them to kind of get them to do what they would do naturally. But here's a plant so disembodied from its native habitat, but if you just pay attention and learn it a little bit, you can coax a pretty happy, healthy plant out of it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's fascinating to see how you can kind of nurse plants through climates that they aren't necessarily adapted to, or get them adapted, because they're, you know, that was one of the things that came from all the experience of growing tropical conifers, you know, through what Atlanta has been doing and through what I got to do thanks to their help and down here in South Florida. You know, they kind of introduced me up there to the notion that a lot of what limited where conifers could grow, you know, versus like the temperate ones that had trouble in the Southeast and whatnot, like the firs, like abies and whatnot. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the temperature per se, but it was actually pathogen pressure and they just seem like a lot of the temperate things were much less resistant to pathogens. And now I'm learning, more experience I get with tropical plants and temperate plants and whatnot, the more I realize that that's, in many cases, that may be a bigger issue than actually the temperature regime. It's kind of what things with it, you know, this.
right. All these unforeseen things that, you know, you want to point fingers at the most obvious fact, but, you know, is it competitive differences or, like you said, pathogen differences? That's what's, you know, that's what you really should be kind of keeping in mind when you're thinking about how plants are going to respond to climate change, or how you're going to bring a new species that's endangered into captivity, to worry about, you know, trying to, like you said, preserve the genetic diversity and bolster these species against the threat of extinction.
Oh, absolutely. And kind of having that intimate knowledge of what things limit their growth and whatnot, you know, that you only really learn from horticulture usually, you know, that can be really, really crucial, and it can give you, it can even, you know, give you insights into ecology that you wouldn't get otherwise, because it's really, it's interesting. That's not something, like, if the pathogen issues don't seem to be something that are often considered as a primary factor in, you know, climatic distribution of plants, but boy, you see it when you try to grow them. I've come to realize that, you know, like a lot of temperate plants, they're amazing because of their ability to adapt to this, you know, really harsh thing called winter. And, you know, the super low temperatures, the dry air, all the things that they have to deal with, you know, and those adaptations are, you know, amazing to that stress. But then in the tropics, there's this biotic stress that's much higher than it is in the temperate zone. You know, basically so many more things wanting to infect you and eat you. And, you know, and then often the tropical plants, you know, have developed these great ways to resist, you know, rotting. And whereas you bring some of the temperate plants and you realize, oh, this isn't just because of it. You know, if you like give them a fungicide or something, they can survive. But if you don't, then they're, and they start to melt, as we say.
Yeah, seriously, that's... Oh, God, I have to change water on my aquarium, and it's got a bunch of crypts in it, and I'm just waiting for them to all melt.
Yes.
Boy.
That's something, the horror.
That's fascinating, and I'm really glad you brought that up, because, you know, this is conservation at work. This is evolution at work. This is understanding, again, that's coming from growing plants, and those are my favorite people, because you learn so many different weird things about individual species from doing it. So, you know, but what about you? I mean, in terms of what's on the horizon, you've got a great career going, you're doing amazing things. What are you excited about in the not too distant future? What's next on your docket for trying to grow? Are there species you got your eyes on, regions of the world you have your eyes on? I know you've been traveling a bit lately. You know, what's on the horizon for Chad?
Well, the horizons keep expanding.
It's good.
One of the wonderful things about the job I do now is that, you know, because I kind of have this wide universe of the plant world to explore, and I don't have to have a lot of preconceived notions of what I'm going to find interesting, which is great or special, and I get to travel a lot. Which is pretty fantastic, because, you know, there's nothing like seeing the plants in their native habitats and seeing people growing them elsewhere and meeting people who can even reveal new wonders of the plant world to you. And so I've, you know, these days, you know, of course, I'm very interested in those selaginellas and trying to get some new ones. In fact, there's apparently a giant species from South America that... Ooh. Another botanical friend of mine, Jeff Benka, who is at the University of California, Berkeley, who's into lycophytes and whatnot. And so, you know, it's a very small community of people who are into those. And so he mentioned there's this, you know, giant one that will actually send down its rhizophores that will actually, like, pierce the leaves of plants as they're coming down.
Whoa.
And whatnot, that climbs into the canopy and gets, and it looks even a little bit like some of the weird climbing ferns. So, so you know, things like figuring out, can we get some of those things into cultivation? How do we get that? And actually also looking, you know, for new fruits is another dimension that I'm interested in, new tropical vegetables and fruits. Cause at Fairchild, we're doing this program with NASA, working with local schools and with NASA to test plants for potentially growing on space missions for food for the astronauts.
Whoa!
And it's called the Growing Beyond Earth Project that was actually spearheaded by our director, Dr. Carl Lewis, and the director of education, Amy Padolf, and they got started working with NASA. And now it's become quite, and I got a chance to go to NASA a couple of months ago and brainstorm on these things, which was pretty fantastic.
Oh,
and one of the
amazing
things, you know, oh, absolutely. And one of the things they're looking at is plants that can grow in a small space, kind of be continuously harvested, you know, which means that tropical plants have great potential for that, that are edible and be nutritious and, you know, also be fairly robust and not, you know, susceptible to disease and whatnot. So there's an area where, yeah, the space program and horticulture can come together, and that's a really
that's
exciting.
Excellent. Does Fairchild have an anti-gravity simulator? Be honest.
Well, we can only hope that's coming down the line. Actually, you know, I guess our ponds or our lakes would be the closest.
There you
thing,
go.
Right?
There you go. Yeah.
But actually, yeah, it's interesting that they actually, for testing the plants for growing in space, they actually, even at NASA, aren't using anti-gravity as much. They're just kind of because the main challenge, they're actually kind of doing tests on anti-gravity, but it's mainly to figure out ways to deliver water, because water in space tends to just, you know, tends to just float around as little, you know, spheres, little kind of droplets in the air. And, you know, it's trying to figure out how to get that onto the roots and so it'll stick. So they have to, you know, have to figure out different fibrous matrices that the roots can grow into that will hold on to the water and deliver them to the roots. And so that there is a, you know, that's a real challenge. And, So, but once you find the plants that otherwise have the characteristics you're looking for, because it turns out that actually the plants will orient to the light pretty well. So as long as you keep the light coming from that direction, most plants will stay upright and won't be.
That's good.
You know, behaving too strangely.
Nice. Oh, that's exciting, man. I mean, just it's so cool that your trajectory went from I just love growing plants to now I'm working with NASA to try and figure out how to grow plants in space. I mean, it's beautiful, and that's what, like, you know, there's so many avenues of attack for different people, bringing in different interests, and it doesn't always have to be the same cookie cutter recipe for success. It's just do what you love, and if you're, you know, a little bit of luck and some meeting the right people, wonderful things can come out of it. And you're just a perfect example of that.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's been wonderful how kind of just following, you know, I've just been following my interests and exploring, and it's turned into wonderful things. And that's, you know, when people ask me, and students especially, like, how do you get into this field? I say, well, you know, I think it isn't like something I planned on, and you know, often it's just kind of being ready to you know, kind of meet the opportunities as they come, and, you know, not being afraid to do things that you're passionate about that might not be the most popular thing at the time. They might not even be what people recommend you should do, but, you know, they can turn into great things. And, you know, and the opportunities for doing these kinds of things have only gotten greater in many ways, because, you know, the information age has kind of opened up, you know, knowledge about different groups of plants and different things you can do with them, that study about them, that, you know, what you had to work a lot harder to get to that in the old days, you know, and that's pretty wonderful. And the fact that, you know, that there is this whole community of people growing plants and getting interested in plants that you can access, you know, through a lot of the social media, you know, like mentioning on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all these, you know, you get into that plant world there and you can see, you know, a whole universe of things that you never thought existed. And then, you know, get in contact with the people who grow and love these plants, or who have seen them and photograph them. And, you know, and so, and they're, you know, and plants are as important as they ever were, if not much more important, you know, because now we have all these conservation challenges that we, you know, didn't have 100 years ago. And right. In addition to all the ways they're useful. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, it's just, I think that people, you know, if people realize that these opportunities can be pursued, you know, quite successfully, I think we'll, you know, because that, I mean, that, and that's one thing that about the plant world that has not changed, is the fact that, you know, just passion for certain groups of plants, for certain ecosystems and whatnot, it just crops up all over the world. You don't know why somebody developed an interest in this or that. And no country, you know, has every kind of botanist or ecologist that they need to care for their, you know, their natural resources. So, you know, it's really a global activity that we still need a, just this wide diversity of people and their interests, and people being willing to follow their passions to conserve these plants and to find the new foods we need for the 21st century, and just to inspire a love for nature and a passion for their, you know, biodiversity is amazing. And it's amazing. It's amazing not just because of what we can get out of it, but just for its own sake. It's just a wondrous,
the intrinsic the wonder of we're this rock hurtling through space, and this is how we've had billions of years of different life forms, and everything is, you know, just trying to survive. And you get a chance in this day and age to have the luxury to appreciate that, and that to me is, you know, something I don't want to ever take for granted. And, you know, it's just really heartening to know that there are people like you in the world working very hard at this. But like you said, there's a whole network of growers out there, hobbyists to professionals, and everyone has their own little thing. And this is, you know, you carve out your little niche, and, you know, for the most part, it's collaborative, and that's beautiful. That's humanity doing good things for itself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful development. And, you know, I think your podcast has become a really wonderful part of that, because
thank you.
And you know, and all your social media, you've been, doing. In fact, I'm starting to recommend that to students and stuff. Say,
oh, geez, good
place,
you
know,
that.
In defense of plants is a great place to kind of look at what's out there in the botanical world. Because
well, thanks, man.
So many different dimensions. It's really so. I really encourage you to keep at it. It's fantastic.
Well, yeah. Thanks. I think in the not too distant future, I'm going to have to hit you up for a behind the scenes tour, what you guys got going on, and come see some of the plants you're growing. But Chad, this has been a long time coming. I'm glad we finally had our schedules overlap to sit down and talk. But I really thank you. If people want to learn more about you, more about what you're doing, how do you recommend they find out about you and what Fairchild is doing?
Yeah, well, I'd recommend just to go to the fairchildgarden.org website. Has all our latest things that are happening, and you know, I like to tweet photos of interesting plants pretty regularly. So I'm on Twitter under my name, Chad Husby, and also Instagram and whatnot. So that's a good way. And I also, when I go on trips, I tend to send out photos of things I'm seeing. And I'm headed to Brazil at the end of the week, so
you lucky
there'll
duck.
Be some interesting new things to see from the plant world of South America. And it's a great adventure, and it's a real privilege to be able to share it with the world.
Great. Well, again, I thank you for taking the time, man. I really appreciate it, and keep up the great work. You're welcome back anytime, and keep us updated. Whatever cool is blooming or growing or throwing up new leaves or getting roots for the first time, keep sharing that with the world.
I certainly will, and thank you. The privilege is all mine to be on your podcast, man, and keep up your wonderful work. And yeah, I'd love to. Come back sometime. Yeah. You're welcome to come with the Fairchild, please.
Oh, I will. Trust me. All right. Cheers.
All right. Cheers. Take
care. Bye.
All right. That's our show. I thank Chad for taking time out of his schedule to talk with us. I think he might have one of the coolest jobs in the world. I don't know about you, but I would love to be in a position like that. I don't know. Someday. I thank him again for talking to us. He's got a lot of work ahead of him. And if you're in that area, you know, reach out, say hi. But know that they're working hard on getting Fairchild back up and in running order for everyone to go and enjoy and appreciate, and again, help take some of the minds off of some of the seriousness that's going on down there. Again, indefensiveplants.com/shop, pick up a sticker, youtube.com/indefensiveplants, check out our videos, patreon.com/indefensiveplants, consider supporting this podcast. Other than that, I've got a lot of cool stuff coming up in the next couple of weeks, so stay tuned. Best way to do that is to hit subscribe. Consider reviewing it at the same time. All right, everyone, this is Matt signing out. Adios.